peace be upon you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, compassionate and merciful. Thank you for having me here. It's a very interesting topic. I'll get right to it because we're short on time. The primary text of Islam is called the Quran, as you may or may not know. Muslims believe that it was revealed to the final Abrahamic prophet. That's a prophet with an uppercase P. His name was Muhammad, peace be upon him, who lived in the 6th and 7th centuries. The Quran explicitly mentions al-Yahud wa al-Nasara, the Jews and the Christians, and gives them the epithet, the honorable epithet of Ahlul Kitab in Arabic, which is translated as the people of the book. So initially, theologians would interpret the book, al-Kitab, as being the Bible, the people of the Bible, because the word Bible, Biblion in Greek, means book, and the Bible in Arabic is called al-Kitab, al-Kitab al-Muqaddas, or the holy book. Now, during the 2nd and 3rd centuries of the Muslim calendar, during the Islamic expansion, Muslims came to realize that there are a lot more religions in the world than just Judaism and Christianity. So theologians at the time, they actually expanded the meaning of the title Ahlul Kitab, the people of the book, to any religion that that reveres some sort of sacred text. So Hindus, Buddhists, Zoroastrians, etc. So under the Muslim polity in pre-modern times, the religious traditions, these religious traditions were given a protected status, freedom of worship, and autonomous rule of their own religious courts. So was there absolutely equal rights amongst all the religions? No, that was not seen anywhere in the world at the time. But what was happening in the Muslim lands was really unparalleled at that time throughout the rest of the world. And this is why we find historical Christian communities in Muslim-majority countries, even today. So were there atrocities committed? Were there people that were oppressive? Yes. But this idea of, you know, hordes of Muslim armies coming in and forcing people to convert is pretty much a myth. Even the man who wrote the book Answering Islam, there's Norman Geisler. He actually says in that book the reason why the North African Christians actually became Muslim so quickly was because of low taxes and stress on brotherhood. That's the power of taxes. But there's a verse in the Quran, the second chapter, verse 256, that says, La ikraha fi din. There's no compulsion in religion, right? And this is important. This is interesting because Pope Benedict XVI, he gave a talk at Regensburg University in Germany, September 12th, interesting date, 2006, where he quoted this verse, there's no compulsion in religion. And he said, this verse is abrogated. Right? This verse has been canceled by other verses in the Quran, which call for fighting the infidel. Right? So abrogation in and of itself is a contentious issue within Quranic sciences. Probably the most authoritative scholar on this issue is an Egyptian scholar named Imam al-Suyuti. You don't have to remember that, but this is a text that Muslim students will know and study called Al-Itqan fi Ulum al-Quran. Anyway, he says in there that there are about 19 or 20 or 21 abrogated verses in the Quran, and this verse is not one of them. I haven't come across a single scholar in my life that has said that this verse, there's no compulsion in religion, has been abrogated. Because it doesn't make sense to abrogate it. You can't force someone to believe in something, right? I can't force you to believe that the moon is made of cheese, right? You can say, oh yeah, I believe, but I can't force that in your heart, so it doesn't make sense that this verse would be abrogated. There's no precedent for that, so I don't know what he's quoting here. We'll give you examples of historical Christian communities in Muslim-majority countries. The Coptic Christians in Egypt, they've been there for 2,000 years. Their claim is that St. Mark founded their church. The Church of the Assyrians in Iraq, which is also called, I think they call it the Ancient Assyrian Church of the East, or Ancient Apostolic Church of the East. Their claim is that St. Thaddeus founded their church. I've lived in Yemen. I've been to monasteries in Yemen. I've met nuns that lived in Yemen. I've been to North Africa. I've met Christians there. In fact, according to Pew, there are 50 Muslim-majority countries, and there are churches in all of them except for two, and that's Saudi Arabia and Mauritania. And Saudi Arabia is sort of weird theologically, but it's interesting. Saudi Arabia, there are 2 million Christians living in Saudi Arabia. There's no churches in Saudi Arabia. There are 2 million Christians living in Saudi Arabia, mostly foreign workers, which is interesting because per capita, there are more Christians living in Saudi Arabia than there are Muslims living in America, which is interesting. So there's about 50 million Christians living in the Muslim-majority world in the Middle East, 50 million, compared to about 44 million Muslims living in Egypt. So there are more Christians in the Middle East than there are Muslims in Europe. Now, if you look at Muslim Spain or North Africa, this is sometimes called the Golden Age of Judaism, right? This is when Jewish systematic theology and philosophy crystallized. You have these major classical Jewish works being produced in Arabic rather than in Hebrew, later translated into Hebrew. I'll just give you a few of them. Kitab al-Amanat wa al-I'tiqadat. It's called Emunot va-Dorot. This is by Sa'diya Gayo al-Fayumi, who's a great scholar in Judaism, Beliefs and Opinions. He wrote this book in Arabic. It's an incredible book. I've thumbed through it a little bit. Very difficult. There's another one, Al-Hidayah ila Fara'id al-Qulub, which is called Chovot ha-Levavot by Rabbi Ibn Pakuda, Duties of the Heart. He wrote this in Arabic. You have Kitab al-Hujja wa al-Dalil, or called the Khuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Then you have the two great works by Maimonides, who's called Musa ibn Maimun al-Qurtubi in Arabic. His first book is called Kitab al-Fara'id, which is in Hebrew, Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of the Commandments. Wrote this in Arabic. And then you have the magnum opus, very, very difficult, but incredible, Dila'il al-Ha'ilin, the Guide for the Perplexed, Moreh Nevuchim, also by the Rambam, Maimonides. So the worldview of the Quran is one in which other religions are acknowledged and accepted, and that these other religions will always be there. So the goal is not global Islamic domination, right? The goal is peaceful coexistence. And the technical legal term for this is musalaha, musalaha. And if you want to do research on the charter, sometimes called the Constitution of Medina, when the Prophet went into Medina, he had a charter or constitution drafted. You can do a Google search on that if you want. However, the Quran does not advocate a type of perennial philosophy where all religions are seen as equally true. According to the Quran, there are correct beliefs and there are incorrect beliefs. There is a way of theologizing or speaking about God that is correct and a way of theologizing that is incorrect. Either God incarnates or he doesn't. Either Jesus is God or he's not. He's either the Messiah or he isn't. The Quran goes into these issues. The Quran encourages interfaith dialogue. The Prophet himself engaged with dialogue with some Nestorian Christians who came to Medina, and he housed them in his mosque for 3 days, and they engaged in interfaith dialogue. So me coming here today is considered what I would say a sunnah, the normative practice of the Prophet himself. There was a Catholic lady who came to the mosque in San Ramon. She was quite elderly. She said, I remember a time when I was not allowed to go into a mosque, pre-Vatican II. Very interesting. Now in with this, when the Prophet was living in Medina, he was the head of state in Medina, the Muslims were living under constant siege in the city. God gave the Prophet and the Muslims permission to physically defend themselves. So the stance in Mecca for 13 years was one of assertive nonviolence. And in Medina, you have active resistance with specific rules of engagement. So the first verse revealed to the Prophet in the Quran, chapter 22, verse 39, that gave him permission to physically defend his city. It sounds like this in Arabic. أُذِنَ لِلَّذِينَ يُقَاتَلُونَ بِأَنَّهُمْ ظُلِمُوا وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَى نَصْرِهِمْ لَقَدِيرٌ. It says, all of these verbs are in the passive. It says, permission is given to those who are being fought against to fight because they have been wronged and indeed God is able to give them victory. So active resistance or martial action can only be called for by legitimate state authority, not by vigilantes, and is used to defend one's community. The very next verse says, "Al-ladina ukhriju min diyarihim bighayri haqqin." Who are these people, the Muslims that are given permission to defend themselves? They are those who are expelled from their homes unjustifiably. Illa an yaqulu rabbuna Allah. Except that they said, our Lord is Allah, our Lord is the God of Abraham. And that also entails a belief in the Quran and in the Prophet Muhammad. And then the Quran says, وَلَوْ لَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسَ بَعْضُهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ. If God did not check one people against another, in other words, if God did not reveal a just war theory, if God did not reveal rules of engagement when it comes to active resistance, the Quran says, لَهُدِّمَ صَوَامِعُ وَبِيَعٌ وَصَلَوَاتٌ وَمَسَاجِدُ يُذْكَرُ فِيهَا إِسْمُ اللَّهِ كَثِيرًا. Then you would have seen many temples, synagogues, and churches and mosques destroyed where the name of God is celebrated. So the initial impetus for active resistance is to ensure religious pluralism according to the Quran, to ensure sacred spaces of worship and devotion for people of various religious traditions. And I preempted questions. This is why ISIS is not Islamic. It is a plague upon humanity that the Prophet actually warned us against. There was a group of early Muslims who broke off the guidance of the Prophet. They were called the Kharijites, right? Or the Khawarij in Arabic. And today we have neo-Kharijites. You know, people who are violent, exclusivists, people who are terrorists. And the Prophet said they come in waves over time. And it's our duty to oppose them. So I want you to remember this analogy. It's a very effective analogy. ISIS is to Islam as the Ku Klux Klan is to Christianity. So a question I get all the time is, why don't Muslims like you, your leaders, your scholars, why don't you go out and condemn ISIS? Right? If you go to a mosque and you start talking about ISIS, Muslims start rolling their eyes. They say, oh, this again? Why don't you talk about something else? Right? So people who ask me this question, I always say to them, have you ever Googled Muslim leaders condemn ISIS? And nobody has ever Googled it. So I'll just mention a few things here. The Islamic Society of North America, or it's called ISNA, they actually released something called the Code of Honor, where they condemn ISIS. This is a huge organization in North America. There's something called the Covenants Initiative. Dr. John Andrew Morrow is spearheading that. This is something that is known in North America as well, where he condemns ISIS and he has signatories to that. There's something called the Open Letter to Baghdadi, the so-called caliph of ISIS. There's 120 signatories by scholars all around the Muslim world. These are people who have sway over the hearts and minds of tens of millions of people condemning ISIS. The Council on American Islamic Relations, which is called CARE, it's constantly condemning and repudiating ISIS. There's something called the Muslim Council of Great Britain in 2014 that released a statement condemning ISIS. There's an incredible book written by an incredible scholar of Damascus. His name is Sheikh Muhammad al-Ya'qubi. He's a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. It's called Refuting ISIS. He wrote it in Arabic and then he himself translated it into English. It's very short. You can probably find it online quite easily, Refuting ISIS, an ideological refutation of ISIS. You have the Muslim Public Affairs Council in 2014 that released a statement condemning ISIS. You have the Amman message, where 200 scholars signed a declaration, Amman, Jordan, denouncing ISIS. You have a fatwa that was issued by Al-Azhar University, the oldest university on the planet in 2014, that denounced ISIS. The Arab League in 2014 made a statement denouncing ISIS. In December of 2015, 100,000 Indian scholars and teachers signed a declaration, 100,000 denouncing ISIS. And then you have the Marrakesh and Morocco declaration denouncing ISIS as well. So these things are out there, but it's strange how they don't make it into the MSM or mainstream media, as it were. I know I'm out of time, so I'm going to stop at this point. Hopefully I answered the question. I'm looking forward to your questions and conversations later. Thank you for your attention.
We now open up the floor to questions, and we do have a microphone that is going to go around, and wherever it is.
That's the one. So you can use this mic here.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. So just raise your hand and you'll get a microphone. There's a person right there. And try to keep your questions short and on the topic, since we only have an hour for this event.
Yes, sir. Oh, you need a microphone. Oh, she has a mic. I'm sorry. Forget about your question.
I'll talk really fast. I'll talk my Boston talk. Thank you very much. It was a very informative talk, and I appreciate it. As a former Catholic, I was condemned to hell if I were to go into a Protestant church, let alone a Muslim place of worship. One of the most glorious experiences in my life was in southern India, when the Muslims, the Christians, and the Hindi all had places of worship and all could walk together on the street. It was absolutely phenomenal. And so my question to you would be, would you ever see that that might happen here in the United States, where we're all accepted of, accepting of others' religions, and we all can openly worship?
I think we have that here. I think with respect to that, America is at the top of the list as far as acceptance and toleration of religions. I'll tell you this: outside of elementary school, I've never experienced any type of. And I used to debate Christians, by the way. I used to be Muslim polemicist when I was an undergrad in high school. You know, you're young, you're not married, you got all this energy. So we go on debate, and I've had nothing but positive responses, and, you know, no one's ever pulled me and insulted me. You know, kids do these types of things because they're kids, right? They don't know. But and it's interesting, I have a friend who lives in Iraq. He's actually my wife's teacher's husband, my wife's Arabic teacher's husband. And I actually, when I was in Yemen, he was one of my teachers there as well. Sometimes we talk, and he says, "Oh, there's American soldiers here around the corner, and you know, I'm just afraid they're gonna kill all of us." And then he says to me, "How are you living in America? Are you constantly threatened every day by people?" And I said, "I've never in my life been threatened one time." So as far as that goes, I think America is actually a model that the rest of the world can actually learn from. Obviously, it's not a perfect society, but what society is perfect, right? Yes. Who has the mic?
Yeah.
And then there's a gentleman here.
Yeah.
I skipped him again. Sorry.
You raised a very important point about the various Muslim organizations that have come out against ISIS. And my question is, why haven't major... I mean, this is big. Why aren't they telling people that Muslims have objected? I mean, that would cover so many, take care of so many concerns.
I don't know. You have to ask them. We have to ask questions like, who actually runs the media?
Yeah.
Those are real questions.
Right.
That I think we're being diverted from. So that's what I would do if I were to go and research who actually, are these people actually doing things for our best interest? What's actually happening? Who are these people? We can find out who the people are.
Yes. Would we see any differences or variations of toleration of other faith traditions between Sunni and Shia Muslims?
That's a good question. Certainly with the invasion of Iraq, it's kind of created a power vacuum in Iraq. Now, Sunnis and Shias have been around for 1,200 years, and in Iraq they've lived in relative peace. The major difference between, and somewhat might even call it a negligible difference, there's really no difference theologically that's major, but the difference is in political theory. Who who should rule the Muslim Ummah or nation, as it were? The Shias say it must be a descendant of the Prophet. So I think a lot of these things, I think there's always been little pockets of disputed violence since the Middle Ages and even before that. But I think with what's going on in the news and the world, those little things are sort of aggrandized and put forward as and presented as sort of this global conflict, you know. So there's the I call it the Santa Claus effect. You know, you have the true Santa Claus, who was a 4th century Christian priest who used to give candy to children, then he died and he's gone. And you have a sort of mythological Santa Claus that flies around at night, goes down your chimney, that doesn't really exist, you know. So a lot of this idea of, you know, your next door neighbor could be Al-Qaeda, you know. So even if he's a nice guy, you know, that's called taqiyya. They learn these words that 99.9% of Muslims have never even heard of. Right? But, you know, people like Daniel Pipes, for example, he puts it out there and says, you know, if a Muslim is nice to you and tells you he doesn't want to kill you, he's lying because he's sanctioned by God to lie to you. That's prudential concealment. And he can do that, they don't kill you later. What? I mean, I did a PhD in Islam, I didn't learn about this. Or he's kidding. I mean, yeah, there's something in the deep, dark sort of recesses of Sharia that, you know, if a guy has a gun to your head and says, are you Muslim? You can say, nope, sure am, to save your life. But this thing is sort of just aggrandized. So this is what all Muslims are doing. They believe in this. That's what they're doing in America. You know, so Sunni Shia differences.
Sorry, can we do one more question? Yes, there's a gentleman back here who's had his hand up.
Okay,
well,
go
so
ahead.
Yeah, okay, I noticed you used the term Muslim majority nations, kind of politically correct term to use, but I don't think we help our situation if we maybe try to, if we obscure what really is going on. So, I mean, because in reality, the history of Islam has been more than just Muslim majority, it's been Muslim rule, Dara, al-Islam. And wherever Islam has spread to, you know, once it got past a certain extent, it has sought to establish its own rule, whether it be, you know, kind of a separatist movement or even taking over governments of the countries where it has spread. So I wanted to, now granted, Christianity had a really bad history of not separating church and state. We have largely learned the lesson of that. I really want to challenge this. I think we have to be honest that there's still a problem with Islam, the lack of separation of mosque and state, and really throughout the Middle East, what you have is they're not Muslim majority nations, you have nations under Islamic rule.
Sir, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, you know, to react to that and say, I think there are a lot of people who probably, you know, maybe feel, you know, think this way, but are maybe afraid to bring that up.
Yeah, so I would agree with you. The pre-modern world, you have empires vying for land. I also think that a lot of what's happening in Muslim majority countries, again to use that what you call a PC term, is a direct result of colonialism in that area that Muslims haven't necessarily recovered from. And then as far as under Islamic rule, you know, there's the Quran does not mandate any form of government. If you can show me a verse in the Quran that says, thou shalt have a theocracy, I'll be glad to agree with you that, you know, there should be no separation of mosque and state. But you have Saudi Arabia, which is a kingdom, you know, and the early Muslims, when the caliphate became a kingdom, a lot of early Muslims, they frowned upon that. You have democratic movements in the Muslim majority countries, like Syria in the 1940s and 50s. Iran, the president or the prime minister of Iran, Mossadegh, actually was a great admirer of Thomas Jefferson, but we can't have him, right? So he was removed from power by the CIA, and the Shah was put in, and the Shah was quite cruel, and he would torture Muslims. My own family members, some of them were tortured by him. And so you have these sort of, I mean, Saddam Hussein is another example. This is someone who's shaking hands with our defense Secretary of Defense in the 1980s, the CIA trained Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and so did MI5. So you have American or Western interests in that region that are turning that region into absolute chaos for different reasons. But you know, you have different forms of government all over the Middle East. So
let's take one more question.
Thank you.
You mentioned that Saudi Arabia is kind of an anomaly in terms of, can you kind of elucidate a little more about how to frame that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Again, we talk about sacred law, Sharia, right? People hear the word Sharia and they start wanting to hide. Sharia literally means a path to cold water, right? So Sharia is an indispensable part of a Muslim's identity. It's like saying you can be a Jew, but you can't follow Halakha law. Or you can be a Christian, but you can't follow the Bible. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, when most Muslims hear the word Sharia, they think prayer and fasting, and like, can I eat this because there's gelatin in it? That's what 99% of Muslims are thinking about. So Sharia is very fast. There isn't one way of doing Sharia, right? So for example, in Afghanistan, again, a country that's been under attack for 40 years, you have places in Afghanistan where women do not leave their homes, and they're not allowed to leave their homes. And if you say, what are you people doing? That's so oppressive. The elders of a certain city will say, this is the Sharia. They can't, that's their interpretation of it. If you go over the border to Iran, half the physicians, and again, Iran's not perfect, no country's perfect, obviously not perfect, but half the physicians in Iran are women. 70% of college students are women. And if you say, well, why is it like this? They say, this is Sharia. Because the Prophet said, طَلَبُ الْعِلْمِ فَرِيدَةٌ عَلَى كُلِّ مُسْلِمٍ. The acquisition of knowledge is an obligation upon every type of Muslim. Right? So it's very vast. Now you have Saudi Arabia. They have their own laws. They say women can't drive cars. Okay. What? That's their interpretation of the Sharia. Right? And as far as theologically, their theological stances are very different than traditional Sunni or even Shi'i stances. So they're very takfiri, they anathematize Muslims that don't believe exactly as they believe. And Saudi Arabia is one of our biggest allies, by the way, which is interesting. But anyway, not getting too much into politics. So theologically, there's sort of an outlier, you know, this idea that if you don't believe exactly as we believe, then we don't consider you Muslim. Traditional Sunni Islam always recognizes difference of opinion, and that difference of opinion, there's actually a hadith, a statement of the Prophet, which is not exactly authentic, but is quoted a lot by scholars as sort of being true in principle, that difference of opinion amongst scholars is a mercy from God. It's not sort of a fitna or a cause of strife amongst people. So there is no true separation of church and state. I mean, you have Rick Santorum wanting to, you know, put abortion into law, and he's doing that because he's a Catholic. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. What I'm saying is there's a difference between a secular society and secularism. The secularism means let's banish religion to the household, right? Not even talk about it at all, right? But a secular society allows for religious discourse, you know? I mean, you can go up there and say, abortion is wrong because the Bible says so. He probably won't get that law passed, but he can try, right? And he might convince a few people. So religion is on the forefront. I mean, everyone in Congress, almost everyone believes in God. So there really is no true separation of religion and the state are never truly divorced anywhere you go around the world. So I think we also have a problem with that. If that's what you want to do, create a totally secular society where there's no religion, then you're in the wrong country.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.